So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're going to begin our program today by talking with Terry Fry. Terry, we had him on, as I think I mentioned in my little introduction earlier, had him on when his book first came out. The book is called Third Down and a War to Go. It came out in hardcover at that time, and we had a wonderful conversation. The book is about the All-American 1942 Wisconsin Badgers football team. Not only the games and the life of campus at that time, but then right after that great season, they went off to do other things. And what did they do? Well, many of them wound up in World War II battling the enemy. And Terry has written a wonderful book. And if you didn't have a chance to talk with him before, I hope you'll join in with us today with your questions and comments and maybe some remembrances, too, at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Terry, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry.
Yeah, nice to have you back.
Thank you. I'm glad I didn't wear out my welcome.
Well, no, you certainly didn't.
Before we get to the callers, I have to say, they better not call in with really, 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 really good stories about 42 Badgers, because we've already revised this book once with contributions like that, the people that I heard from after the hardback came out. So there's a lot of that in the paperback.
Yeah, I was really surprised that you were given quite a bit of latitude as an author. Usually when the soft cover comes out, there might be a little paragraph or two at the end.
I'm laughing because of my corresponding experiences on the two books that I've had out so far. The first one was from Simon & Schuster, and it was called Horns, Hogs, and Nixon Coming, and it was about the 1969 Texas-Arkansas football game and all the swirling events and kind of perfect storm elements involved in the anti-war protests, Nixon coming to the game, the draft lottery that week, Bill Clinton's involvement. And the reason I'm laughing is because that paperback I did not control the rights to. And so Simon & Schuster sold the paperback rights to Taylor Trade, who I love because they're publishing my next book too in hardback. But they just took essentially the plates of the book and put a paper cover on it and reissued it. In this book, the Wisconsin Historical Society, with which I've had a tremendous partnership, mm-hmm. and you should all be proud of having that organization in your state. And I agreed. We originally, as part of the contract, agreed a paperback could not be published until 2007, but I controlled the paperback rights. And so when we initially discussed putting out a paperback of this book, I said I would like to be able to go back into the book and add all the things that I had been made aware of since the publication of the hardback, and at the reaction from the Wisconsin constituency and people around the country who recognized it as kind of a universal snapshot type story of America at the time, the contributions I got from people after publication were just so tremendous. I put a lot of them into this repackaged and written, essentially,
yeah.
paperback edition of this book. And so...
Heck of a lot more work for you.
Yeah, it was. I made a mistake. Now, nobody's going to, tell on me. We're speaking among friends here. I told my agent after the fact. And I got a... we had a little bit of a divorce. It was kind of in the offing before that. But when I went to the Wisconsin Historical Society for the paperback, it was for the express purpose that we were going to turn this into a repackage and new book, including all the tremendous material I had come across since publication of the hardback. I would be a little more sheepish about it had I not realized that there was a certain time frame involved in getting the hardback out. A personal timetable, because yeah. a lot of the men in the book were in ill health,
yeah.
and unfortunately a lot of them have died since the hardback came out. I wanted the hardback out when it came out, by who and with whom it was published, and I was tremendously proud of the job the Wisconsin Historical Society did. So when it came time to negotiate the paperback rights, when the Historical Society, which had done such a tremendous job of the hardback, said, sure, let's do that, let's make it a new book, I said, okay, we're doing it. And so we never did put the paperback rights up for bid. And I don't pretend that I would have been, you know, buying a vacation house on Malibu with the money from the paperback rights, but we never did put it up for bid. And that cost me my agent and it cost me some sleep, but I'm glad. I'm very, very happy with the way this has turned out.
Yeah, it's really a wonderful book. And, you know, you had a lot of emotional investment in the book and in the story itself just because of the relationship with your dad.
My father was a 18-year-old sophomore guard on that 1942 team, and he never pretended over the years to be anything but a reserve on that team. He was a backup. He was only 18 years old as a sophomore. He was one of those guys who graduated from high school down the road in Stoughton at age 16 and came to Madison as a 16-year-old college freshman.
Ooh.
And so he was 18 years old in that 42 season, and he was one of the players who enlisted in the Army Air Forces and was called into service in early 1943. After getting a card that's saying you're deferred until 1945 when you graduate, but that was part of the deal. They all knew it. They all went down and bugged the general to call him in, and they went off. And he was a P-38 fighter pilot in the Pacific. And in the original, some of the original things I'd done with the material in this book, he greatly belittled his own talent as a pilot. And I was immediately chewed up by folks with a much deeper knowledge of our aeronautics policy in World War II and whenever that, boy, if you were given a P-38, you were a good pilot.
No.
So he flew 67 missions. He got his wings at age 19. He flew 67 missions as a P-38 reconnaissance pilot in the unarmed version of the plane, and then came back, played for Wisconsin again in 1946 and 1947, while my mother, who was also from Stoughton, taught school here in Madison. And then he loaded up the car, went out to Oregon, became a major college football coach at the University of Oregon, is the head football coach there during times of turbulence and trouble in the country, and ended up coaching the National Football League and spending a long career in the National Football League until his 2001 death. And I was prodded to do this book by realizing how much little knowledge and only surface knowledge I'd had of my own father's war experiences until I talked with him about it very late in his life, and seeing that 1942 team picture on the wall and realizing they all went through that.
Yeah.
That season was their final fling, that they all went off to the war. And frankly, when I started the research, I didn't know very much. And after spending much of the summer of 2002 in Wisconsin and doing initial research and then also traveling around the country to track some of these guys down and speak with them, we came out with a hardcover in 2004. So I found, and I was astounded by the stories I discovered of the both major and minor players on the team. And I think that's important to emphasize that this was a democratic little D experience.
Yeah, it certainly was. And some of the stories in there, you have some very memorable stories. Tell us, maybe we can talk before we go to the phones here, what was it like around here in Wisconsin and the campus in 1942? It was a different kind of life than it is today.
Well, you know why I'm smiling? The similarities are stunning also.
You know,
there is a letter in the book that Dave Schreiner wrote home after Dave Schreiner, who was the two-time All-American and co-captain of this team, kind of the All-American boy and the guy who worked in the girls' dormitory cafeteria, which I think most All-American football players do nowadays, right? So those times have changed. But he wrote home a letter saying he was disgusted by all the drinking on campus and in the fraternity and how he'd been distracted from his appointed rounds and duties by some of these things going on campus. And the other additional element on that is in 1942, after Pearl Harbor, in early 42, when they all enlisted in the EERC and the enlisted corps, and were essentially reserves, and then kind of picked out their own branches of the service to be called into the service when they were needed. They knew they were going to at some point probably be headed off to the war. So that fall of 42 in the 1942 football season was a final fling. You could tell they were rather exuberant in their participation in life on campus and celebration, and I think it was a pervasive atmosphere on campus of that final fling atmosphere. You know, there it wasn't as carefree as some of the elements in the partying you have on campus now today, but they clearly knew what they were headed for, and that's whether you were the assistant editor of the yearbook or the co-captain of the football team.
And maybe did that play? I mean, these guys had great ability. That must have also played a little bit of a role, though, in their the wonderful run they had in 1942.
It was a commonality among them and every team they played that they knew that.
Yeah,
and so
true.
I think there was kind
true.
Of a spirited atmosphere on the field, mm-hmm. even more so than usual. That yeah, this is football. This is important, but we know there are going to be other things on the horizon. And let's face it, in the fall of 1942. Increasingly, their contemporaries were leaving campuses and leaving regular life to head overseas. They were getting word of people from their hometowns dying in action. They knew what was going on. And as everybody knows, and especially in the early 1942, things were not going particularly well. And so the daunting realities on the horizon were pretty obvious.
KC in Port Wing will give you a chance. Hi, KC. Thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. This is a wonderful show. I want to talk about one person from my hometown who went ashore on D-Day, June 6, 1944. He was a sergeant in the U.S. Army. His name was Ivar Bodin, and he was awarded the Silver Star and the Purple Heart. He took a machine gun burst across the chest, and not once did he ever talk about it. He never bragged about it, and the day he died, that's on his headstone. And he is from my hometown, Port Wing, Wisconsin, and I'm extremely proud of him.
I thank you very much. I thank you very much for calling, KC, with that. You know, and guys like even Bodine made it in some ways for you. I would expect a little more difficult putting your book together because a lot of people didn't want to talk about the things that they did.
I'm going to talk about an example that's peripherally in the book, because this was so typical. In the ancillary research involved, there was a football game among the United States Marines in the 6th Division on Guadalcanal on Christmas Eve 1944. And it's a crucial element in the book because Bob Bauman, Len Seelinger, and Dave Schreiner, all three played in that football game between the 4th Regiment and the 29th Regiment. And going and doing this research, I recognized a name. Actually, I recognized a couple of names. And one of them was Walter Bergman from Colorado A&M, Colorado Aggies, it was called. And he was a halfback on the 29th Regiment team playing against Bauman and Schreiner. So I recognized that name. He was a renowned and very popular coach over in Grand Junction, Colorado. I live in Denver. And he was in Grand Junction, Colorado. And I recognized his name. I went over and saw him. I did a big newspaper story on him for the Denver Post about this football game on Christmas Eve. And his war service, like all the other guys in that game, virtually all the other guys in that game, he went on to Okinawa, to the Battle of Okinawa. And 12 guys who played in this renowned touch football game on Guadalcanal were killed in action on Okinawa, and these were very good football players, All-Americans, pro football players. And so I saw Bus Bergman, so I went over and did a newspaper story on him. And he told me about knowing Dave Schreiner and Bob Bauman, and that's in the book. And we talked specifically about his experiences on Okinawa, and his wife called me aside and said, "Has he told you about the Bronze Star?" And I said, "No."
No.
She says, "Well, ask him about the Bronze Star." Now, he was mad. He's literally mad that his wife had told me about that. And so I asked him about it. It was in the newspaper story. But to retreat a little bit, she's showing me pictures on the wall, his wife. And this is Walter Jr. This is our other blah, blah, blah. And he says, "And you know, Jane, and there's a picture of a woman up on the wall with President Bush 41. I'm like, "Wait a minute. That's our lieutenant governor. Jane Norton." And so that she didn't have the same name, so that confused me. I wrote the story. It came out. Lieutenant Governor Norton made it be known that the things he talked about in that story, she didn't know. hadn't been only peripherally had any knowledge of it because he wouldn't talk about it. I was there at the right time with a tape recorder and with some elements of documentation that showed I knew what I was talking about, and I was catharsis for him. I think that cathartic experience has happened with hundreds of thousands of veterans. And one of the pleas I make in this book is that, my God, and it's probably too late now. I mean, it's 3 years since the publication of the hardback, that ask them about it. And if they will talk to you, talk about it. And I'm fully aware that some of them didn't ever want to talk about it again. And I've had all kinds of offshoot experiences like that. It happened with many of the men in Third Down and A War to Go. I told the story about in the original hardback version. Dave Donnellan was a backup guard on that team. He's still alive. He lives up in Eau Claire. Mm-hmm. His name's on about half the realty signs up there, Donnellan Real Estate, folks. I did not get in the original hardback that he won the Bronze Star in the Battle of the Bulge. And I didn't have it in there, of course, because he didn't tell me.
He didn't tell you.
So his family, of course, made me aware of that after the fact, and we got that in the second printing of the hardback, and it indeed is in the paperback. But that happened time and time again. There were many families involved who just didn't know things, and these guys didn't want to talk about it. My father, and I tell the story in the book, and I still marvel at it. My father was a head football coach at the University of Oregon. Pac-10 conference, major conference, went on and coached in the National Football League with Tampa Bay, Chicago, and Denver. His coaching biography said, and I'm quoting almost verbatim here, "Jerry played football at Wisconsin in 1942, 46, and 47. After his graduation, he moved on to Portland to be high school, blah, blah, blah."
Didn't say a thing about the war.
Not one word.
Yeah.
And and I'm thinking about this. As I look back, my father coached at Oregon. They played Oregon State every year. Big game. Battle for the right to live in the state of Oregon. It's called the Civil War. You're supposed to hate each other. Oregon State's coach was D. Andros, affectionately known as the Great Pumpkin. And Oregon State is an Aggie school, proudly so. It was somewhat of an oasis in the anti-war sentiment of the 60s. And D ran a tight ship. And sometimes my father's attitude of, he'd never explained it. And if he'd explained it, Dad, you should have told people this. his attitude was, when I was 19, I was a P-38 fighter pilot. And when I was 20, I was flying unarmed over Japanese targets in the Pacific. At 20 years old, I am not going to tell 19, 20, 21-year-old college football players what to think, how to wear their hair, what to do, that there's a certain amount of adult responsibility here that I'm going to bestow upon my football players. And a lot of people in Oregon did not like that. They contrasted it with DeAndros at Oregon State, who suspended a black player, for having a goatee, which caused great consternation in Oregon, and the black students boycotted basketball games over this, for example. My father always got along with Oregon State's coach, DeAndros. And nobody could figure out why. You're playing the biggest football game of the year. You guys are great friends. You play golf together. You've got differing coaching philosophies. The reason was DeAndros was a Marine on Iwo Jima. My father was in a P-38 fighter plane flying over them in the Pacific. Now, after that, you think they're going to get mad at each other over a stupid football game?
Terry Fry, our guest today, author of Third Down and A War to Go, the All-American 1942 Wisconsin Badgers. Terry's a columnist for the Denver Post, .com and ESPN.com as well. We're really pleased to have him with us today. If you'd like to join in with a question, a comment, feel free at 1-800-642-1234, or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Terry Fry about his book, Third Down and A War to Go. It's published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Really pleased to have him with us today. It's an updated, significantly updated version from his hardcover that came out 3 years ago now, was it, Terry?
Yeah.
About 3 years ago?
And I'm telling people, if you have the hardback and you feel cheated, please, please, please get your neighbor to buy the paperback and then steal it.
Okay.
It's about I would say 25% revised from the hardback. And it is significantly better. I am somewhat sheepish about that. But I'm realistic that it did take the hardback coming out to shake some of these stories from the trees, and we had to get the hardback out when it did come out.
If you'd like to join in, the number to call 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. And by the way, you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Let's talk. You have a couple of main characters. Oh, there's a lot of characters in the book, but Had Hoskins and Dave Schreiner are kind of two guys that you sort of feature in a way. Schreiner, in particular, because heck, he was an All-American 2 years in a row.
I think they're at the core of the story. Mark Hoskins, Hadley Mark Hoskins, and Dave Schreiner, and I'm proudly showing you the picture on page 4 of the paperback of young Dave Schreiner and Had Hoskins. He was called Had over in Lancaster, standing there looking like they just finished having Tom Sawyer talk them into painting the picket fence. It was Tom Sawyer, wasn't it? I always forget. It was either Tom Sawyer or Huckleberry Finn. But they were young, mischievous boys over in Lancaster, Wisconsin, who ended up at the University of Wisconsin together. As co-captains of the football team. Can you imagine two guys from such a small town, Lancaster, over in southwest Wisconsin, ending up as co-captains of the 1942 Badgers? And so their friendship, lifelong friendship, touching friendship, is at the core of this book. And they came over together and ended up co-captains of that team. Dave Schreiner wanted to be a pilot along with Had Hoskins, his buddy Hoskins, and he had a color blindness problem that eventually didn't allow him to enter the Army Air Forces. Mark Hoskins did go into the Army Air Forces and ended up a bomber co-pilot who was shot down over. I'm a little less reticent to tell some of the punchlines now because I think most people now know the stories. But it's one of the strengths of the story. I think the dramatic tension still exists and still can drive you to turn the page. But Mark Hoskins was shot down on his 34th mission over Hungary and ended up in Stalag Luft III, the Great Escape prison camp. So that's at the core of the book. Dave Schreiner ends up in the 6th Marine Division and eventually on the in the Battle of Okinawa in the same company with his teammate, also as a first lieutenant, Bob Bauman, and they were both killed in the Battle of Okinawa. And that is the core of the story. I've been asked many times, and I've been asked by people both who are full of hot air and potentially, I hope, full of money about the movie version of this, about which there have been many inquiries. We've never gotten to the point. I refuse to turn over the rights to it as a property and have somebody option it and sit on it. And so that's one of the reasons it hasn't sold yet. I've been a hard negotiator in that sense. But I know that when I distill down the version for a screenplay adaptation, which I'm going to try to do the second I get home from this trip, is to make it probably focus on the Lancaster boys, Hoskins and Schreiner, and peripherally Bob Bauman, and tell the story of the 42 season as kind of a background and a backdrop, but turning it more into the story of Mark Hoskins and Dave Schreiner. When they went off to the war and they were separated, Dave Schreiner gave Mark Hoskins his Shrine Game, East-West Shrine Game All-Star watch. And so there were touching elements like that. I ended up speaking with Mark Hoskins, who was living in San Diego at the time. His wife since has moved back to Lancaster. His son is still in Lancaster, Mark Jr. And I went out and finally was able to speak with Mark out in San Diego. And that interview was very wrenching for me, very touching, talking about his friendship with Dave Schreiner, talking about having Dave Schreiner's All-Star Game watch hearing about Dave Schreiner's death and musing about what Dave Schreiner could have been or would have been had he lived. And I think those two in kind of microcosm form the tale, form the tale for a distilled down version. And you're looking at the back cover now,
right.
The paperback. It's kind of funny. I'm smiling now. Mark Hoskins is pictured in an individual picture in his Army Air Force garb. Dave Schreiner is pictured in his Marine Corps garb in an individual shot. And I was so ecstatic. I congratulated everybody at the WHS for the juxtaposition of the pictures and the artiness of this and the appropriateness of it, because their pictures are superimposed over the team picture. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens that there's a guy right here in the middle between the team between their headshots, and there's a guy at the right in their football gear in the team picture. Well, it's Mark Hoskins and it's Dave Schreiner. Yeah. And I said, "Boy, that's great. How did you know? That's so arty. That's so great. I guess it was an accident."
Oh boy, John in Lancaster, we'll give you a chance. Hi, John.
Hi.
Thank you for calling.
I guess I just wanted to make one comment that he may or may not be aware of, is that at the time that Dave's mother went into the nursing home and wasn't able to return, they put her house up for sale. And when we looked at their house, you would go up
the bedroom.
To the bedroom, and all the stuff was originally there.
His mother lived to be 105 years old. And I think, wasn't she 99 when she moved out of the house? I think that's right.
Right. And this was several years after, because she was in the nursing home, obviously, for some time. So it was a very poignant scene.
His mother and his father were older. And Bert Schreiner, his father, never recovered from the grief of this and died a few years later. And his mother, Anne, lived to be 105. And again, always revered his memory. And I came across and got access to, there is a collection of his letters here at the Wisconsin Historical Society. The bulk of them are in possession of the family and were passed down to his niece, Judy Corfield, who's in Illinois, in the Chicago area. And so I spent just an amazing amount of an amazingly rewarding period going over the material at Judy Corfield's house down in Illinois. And they kept letters, they kept postcards, they kept scrapbooks, they kept everything. And so that the information on Dave Schreiner from the family was just tremendous. I did go over to Lancaster in my last time through Wisconsin and appeared at Lancaster High School and spoke there. And some of the people who showed up who knew both had Hoskins and Dave Schreiner, that made it particularly rewarding as well.
And I can tell you that there, I have at least one student advisee of mine who's from Lancaster and a young guy, but believe me, he knows all about Dave Schreiner and Head Hoskins, that's for sure. That memory is, has stayed. John, thank you. Mike and Racine, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. This is a great show, and I'll have to buy the book and read it today. But could you comment on the kind of the role of college football in the culture of the 1940s and compare it today? Today we have all the competition with professional sports. What was the role of college football in terms of being a rallying point for the state of Wisconsin in the 1940s, and how does it compare or contrast to circumstances today?
Yeah, that's a good question, too.
I think there are a lot of similarities and there are a lot of differences. It's a kaleidoscope that way. It just depends on how you turn the thing. In the 40s, they were rarely recruited in the sense of being begged to come to the university and play football. It was, if you're coming, we may be able to get you a job. We may be able to do that. Boosters paid for Elroy Hirsch's way here, for example. There was nothing wrong with that. You just pooled your money and sent a guy off to college.
Yeah.
And that's what they did. Most of these guys had part-time jobs. My father had he worked at Toby and Moon's restaurant. And he also had the grueling job, which many football players did, of living in one of the firehouses, and his job was to close the door after the fire trucks went out. That was the cush job for football players, but Dave Schreiner worked in the dormitory. But as a item of focus in rallying, I think it was very similar to what you see today. I mean, they were the marquee program in the state. Marquette was still playing football at the time, but they were the marquee program in the state, kind of the rallying point. They were the big man on campus. And in that sense, I think football is still the same. I've also been sometimes questioned about this, and I've been confronted by it and held in contempt by some, that I really believe that the strength of this group was not, and when I say group, I mean that generation and those the kids, quote unquote, which I never believe in calling college age people kids, but I'll do it anyway. Their strength in my mind was not saying, "My God, let us at them." It was, "What do you want us to do? We'll do it." And I think that's a crucial distinction, and I hope that comes across in the book. I think there's been some mythologizing done over the years about that element. I think it's even more praiseworthy that they said, "What do you want us to do?"
Yeah.
Than it is to portray them as saying, "Let us at them."
Yeah. Thank you, Mike, for calling. Ray in Eau Claire, it's your turn now. Hi, Ray. Thanks for calling.
Okay, thank you, Larry. And Terry, thanks for appearing today. Not only the guys who were wearing the cleats up and down the field on the green those days, but you know, during halftime, I think the Badgers were marching back then. And my uncle was a music major and a good tenor sax player, but, of course, when Pearl Harbor happened, he enlisted. And he went to flight school and was flying a Lightning when he was, I think he was ferrying it across to the in New York. He had engine problems, and he had to put it down really hard. There wasn't any space except for a small field for his any satisfactory glide path. And they were able to get a priest to him, and he died of it. About 20 minutes later. So, yeah, not just the guys in the helmets, but some of the guys carrying instruments.
Yeah, commercial. I did hear from some members of the band who told me some funny stories about being down there when, in Soldier Field, for example, when the players ran by. And you're in Eau Claire, so, you know, three of the surviving members of the team are up there. Don Litchfield, who was a bomber pilot, his travails in a mission to Berlin are detailed in the book. He owns Litchfield Auto Sales up there in Eau Claire. If you drive by, stop in, say hello, and thank you. And Dave Donnellan, who owns Donnellan Real Estate up there, you'll see his signs all over town. His sons are kind of in control now, but Dave still goes to the office and works. And John Gallagher was one of the V-12 Marines who was a longtime football coach and principal up there. Of the Eau Claire is a Memorial Old Abe's. Or what?
Yep.
I was indoctrinated what Old Abe's meant, so I know what that means. So those three members of the team are still up in Eau Claire.
On occasion, I will remember that to him. One final thought about the P-38. It was Admiral Yamamoto who planned the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yamamoto.
And this curious thread of history that has bound his life with my uncle's because of his attack on Pearl Harbor, we were immersed in war. My uncle went in, enlisted, became a P-38 pilot, which took his life. But it was just a few years later, with intercepted Japanese military transmissions, Yamamoto was flying supposedly a secret mission among some of the Japanese-held islands, but a squadron of P-38s was waiting for him.
Yeah, and I read the book about that, the one that recently came out, and God, I'm an author, I should remember this stuff, but I don't remember the name of the book. But I read it, and it was interesting, so much dispute over who actually shot down Yamamoto, and apparently the wrong guy was given credit for it for so many years. But they did, you know, and the irony, of course, is Yamamoto wasn't necessarily in favor of starting the war in the first place.
What, the book's done very well.
Thank you.
The book's done very well. It's sold very well. It's been written very well. I know you're going to be making some appearances, or are you making some appearances? I should ask that.
Well, first of all, the major one is tonight.
Yeah.
At the Veterans Museum on the square, 7 o'clock. I will don't let this deter you, folks. I will make a speech, a presentation, talk about the process of writing the book, mostly the reaction to it since the hardback came out, because I think I've maybe some of the people in the audience will have heard some of the surface things about the research, but I will talk about that, and then we'll have a book signing. And to emphasize, when we say book signing, yeah, there will be copies of the new paperback for sale. You're certainly welcome to come in, buy that, have me sign it. But if you have a copy of the book and want to come in and listen and then have me sign that existing copy of the book, if it's a hardback, I'll apologize and try to point to the pages in the paperback that you can at least skim it at your neighborhood bookstore. But the hardback is essentially the outline of the story. You get most of it. The paperback, I think, is a supplement to that. And again, I apologize. I'm a little bit sheepish about it, but it was the way it just had to be done.
And so it's tonight?
Tonight, 7 o'clock, the Veterans Museum.
In Madison.
In Madison on the Capitol Square.
Well, I tell you what, Terry, it's always a pleasure. I know you've got another book coming out, and a new book, and that's, what's it called?
77. And that's... I wanted to call it 77 Sunset Strip, and they told me that was already taken. It's about the year 1977 in Denver. It is a little regional-centric, I guess it is, but it's about a pivotal year in the history of Denver, Colorado, primarily focusing on the 1977 Denver Broncos football team that went to the Super Bowl that year, got waxed by the Dallas Cowboys. But it was Denver's kind of first exposure to the big time. I was a rookie newspaper reporter. Hard to believe 30 years ago. I was a rookie newspaper reporter in Denver. And I saw all that up close personal as a rookie in the business. So I'm writing about the maturation of Denver as a market, the maturation of Colorado. And one of the central figures in the book turns out to be Governor Richard Lamb, who is from Madison, Stephen Ambrose's roommate.
Yeah.
And everybody who has read the galleys and the proofs have had the universal reaction of, my God, Governor Lamb steals that book. He talks about how he was a young, impetuous, no political skills, and I mean that in the sense of diplomacy, governor at war with kind of our final machine type mayor in Denver, Bill McNichols. And so he does come close to stealing the book. It again is a combination of character portraits, social history, and politics. But it's about Denver, Colorado, 1977. That'll be out in November. It'll probably sell like hotcakes, and I'll be a little embarrassed because it's nowhere near the emotional involvement that third down and a war to go. I've heard a lot of people ask the question, authors get asked the question, what's your favorite book? And they dodge the question, or they say, well, you kind of have to say, well, it's the most rewarding experience as opposed to, no, my favorite book. I don't care how many I write, how many more I write. My first one, Horns, Hogs, and Nixon Coming, was very well received. But this is going to be my favorite book, third down and a war to go. And if somebody asks me at a signing for 77 or I give speeches about 77, I'll say, you know, this book's okay. But this is the one I want you to read. You do not broadcast to Colorado, do you?
Well, I've never gotten a call from Colorado, We get calls from all over the United States because some people listen online, but they're typically those who do are originally from Wisconsin and they like public radio.
Okay. So if you're listening in Colorado, by any means, the next book is very, very, I'm very proud of it, but I don't have the emotional investment in it.
Thank you, Terry.
Thanks, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. Terry Fry, author of the book Third Down and a War to Go, The All-American 1942 Wisconsin Badgers. And even if you're not a big sports fan or
interested that much in football, I think you're going to get a lot out of this book, and I highly recommend it to you. It's published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. And hopefully we'll get him back and we'll talk about 77 the next time he comes rolling through, or maybe we'll get him on by phone. We're going to be talking science next in the Nature of Science Research with Bassam Shakashiri, coming up here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.